Uber launched its pilot program of driverless cars in Pittsburgh recently. Pittsburgh has become the hub for this technology. And to create a proper buzz around the launch, Uber invited a couple of journalists to go on ride-alongs. That proved to be a stellar PR move. We heard all about this.
The future is now.
The inside of a self-driving Uber is different.
We're standing next to one right here in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
This feels completely normal, the whole thing from calling it, sitting back here. I would have no idea that this car was driving itself.
The turn signal came on automatically and now it's turning itself.
One of the reporters invited was Liz Reed from our partner station WESA in Pittsburgh. Here she is getting into her driverless Uber.
So I'm going to click on this button that says let's ride to get started on the iPad. And it's asking me if my seatbelt is fastened. Two rider maximum, no destination changes. We are all set. So I'm going to push all set. Here we go, it says.
Liz wasn't in this car all by herself. There were two co-pilots sitting up front, making sure that everything went off without a hitch. And Liz is here now to debrief a little bit about her ride. Hi, Liz.
Hi, Maiken.
I listened to a lot of the news coverage. And it felt like, I don't know what I expected, but it felt a little bit less exciting than perhaps what I had hoped for.
I would say that's an accurate statement. And I would say I identify with that as well. At first, you know, I was really excited about this. They had lined up these 14 cars outside the Uber offices, and they've all got these futuristic looking sensory devices mounted on the roof. And they told us beforehand, you know, there's 64 channels of lasers collecting 1.4 million distance measurements every second. So it's like, wow, that's amazing. And they have all these cameras on them. It felt very much like a one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind kind of moment. But then we got in the car, and there was this iPad welcoming us by name and then showing us a rendering of our surroundings, which was pretty cool. But then the sheen sort of started to fall away shortly after our ride in the car actually began. And it became clear that this technology is still a long, long way from really changing the way we move around cities.
What do you mean? What didn't work for you?
Well, you know, Uber and other self-driving car makers, they have to err on the side of safety, which makes sense. But what does that mean when you're trying to program safety into a computer? So here's an example. We were coming up on a car that was parallel parking, and though there was room to change lanes and go around it, our car stayed put and just waited. You know, that's fine. It didn't really waste too much time, but it's probably not what most human drivers would have done. Most people would have gone around the car because there were no other vehicles approaching in that lane. And what's really interesting, it looks like other reporters had the same experience, but just a little bit different. And my favorite one that I've read is from Nathan Ingram of Engadget. His car came to a four-way stop, and because it's programmed to drive as safely as possible, it was waiting for the other cars that were going in different directions to come to a full and complete stop before it would move. And maybe this is just a Pittsburgh thing, but very few drivers actually fully stop at a stop sign. You know, they just kind of slowly might roll through it. And so because of that, the Uber car didn't move. Though it had the right-of-way several times, it didn't move. And so basically, the human driver had to take over in order to get the car to continue on its way.
So it sounds like Uber needs to program in a little bit less of my grandmother and a little bit more of my Uncle Klaus, who always had a sports car and was just like honking at everybody and swerving and going.
Yeah, I mean, you can imagine, you know, this is during midday and this is a very benign situation when traffic was very light. When you extrapolate that to rush hour, it's easy to imagine the Uber car just being completely paralyzed in a city like Pittsburgh, let alone New York City or LA, where the traffic gets really crazy. You know, sometimes human drivers have to make these risky moves to get where they're going. There's a lot of instantaneous risk-reward calculations we're making, and it really remains to be seen whether autonomous vehicles will be able to do that.
Liz, thank you so much.
Thank you, Maiken.
Liz Reed is a reporter with WESA in Pittsburgh, and while you don't want a driverless car to be ridiculously timid, safety is obviously front and center here. Most deadly car crashes are caused by human error, so it means there's potential to save lives here, but these driverless cars have to do better than us. Federal regulators just released a 15-point safety checklist for driverless cars. Here are a couple of examples of what's outlined. The cars have to be able to switch safely from autopilot to human driver. They have to be able to avoid sudden problems, such as a falling tree, and they have to obey the speed limits across state lines. But there's also a line item on ethical questions, asking car makers to be transparent about how the vehicle will respond in a no-win situation. Somebody's going to die, but who? This brings us to something known as the trolley problem.
What philosophers call a thought experiment. My first name is Iyad, and surname is Rahwan. I'm an associate professor at the MIT Media Lab.
The trolley problem goes like this. A runaway trolley is speeding along, and its brakes are not working.
And it's moving unstoppable on a train track.
The trolley is about to kill 5 people.
Who are, for some reason or another, stuck on the track. Maybe they're 5 workmen fixing the track and they don't have enough time to move off the track.
But there's another track the trolley could move onto. There, it would kill 1 worker.
And you are in control of a lever that you can pull in order to move the trolley to the second track.
Would you pull that lever and kill 1 worker and save 5 lives, or do nothing and kill 5? Iyad Rahwan says, broadly speaking, 2 schools of philosophical thought guide the response. One is utilitarianism.
Which means I should take the action that will produce the best outcome. And in this case, the best outcome is to kill fewer people, so I should pull the lever.
On the other side is duty-based or deontic ethics.
We should not do something that is fundamentally wrong. So the action itself of killing a person through performing an act is intrinsically wrong, regardless of the outcome. And therefore, those people will just receive their fate. And a human being is wrong to take an action that will alter that.
Rahwan works at MIT, and he is one of the people who is really trying to get everybody involved in these ethical issues around this new technology.
It is possible for a scenario to happen in which a driverless car may run over people because it fails to stop. And it's also conceivable that the car may take a different course of action in this situation. Now, the fundamental difference is that now it is not a human being with ethical intuitions who is making these decisions, but rather it's a computer program. It's an algorithm that is designed and built by people, but that is acting autonomously in the real world in that moment.
But do we as humans do any kind of ethical analysis before making a decision in a situation where we might crash into a wall, killing ourselves, or we might crash into a crowd of people?
That's a very good question. So obviously, humans do not make any sort of explicit, conscious, ethical analysis in these scenarios. What happens mostly is people freak out, they freeze, and they do an action that is random, that is driven by their gut feeling or their fear or their self-preservation instinct. Now, the difference here is that for the first time in the history of automotives, we are able to make that decision prior to that moment. So, in a way, you now have a moral imperative to make the right choice.
So, Rahwan and his colleagues have created a website. It's called Moral Machine. And when you go on, you can go through a couple of different scenarios and you have to make choices. There are side-by-side images of a car about to get into an accident. Simple images looks a little bit like in a driver's manual from the DMV when you were first getting your permit. So the car could be programmed to go straight. That would mean killing pedestrians. Or the car could be programmed to swerve off, hit a barricade, and kill the people in the car. That would include you. So you have to click on one or the other, and then the scenarios keep changing up. Sometimes there are more people in the car, sometimes fewer. The pedestrians are older, younger. They are bank robbers or doctors. So it gets really hairy.
We wanted people to confront the difficulty of making those types of moral decisions and to appreciate the complexity of those types of trade-offs that regulators and lawmakers have to make. If society does not want those cars to discriminate based on gender or age, for example, then society needs a way to articulate those expectations, and we need to ensure that they are implemented.
How do you think all of this will enter the production of these vehicles? I mean, ultimately, as a customer, don't I want a vehicle that will prioritize me?
Of course. So in our study, the first thing we found was that people, by and large, wanted cars to be utilitarian. So they wanted the cars to minimize total harm, regardless of whether it was sacrificing the passerby that the car would swerve towards, or whether the car would sacrifice the passenger in the car. But the catch is that when we asked people whether they would purchase such cars, they all said absolutely not. And this is not really surprising. People have a self-preservation instinct. So I think it's not about what the car should do in scenario A or scenario B, but it's about the how society as a whole can come to an agreement about what matters to us more and how we can enforce this agreement. So if everybody wants cars that, in aggregate, minimize the death toll, minimize the total harm from accidents in general, we need a way to enforce that. So I need a way to make sure that if I purchase a car that may, in a very unlikely scenario, may sacrifice me, I need to make sure that I'm not the only one doing that and that everybody else is buying into this social contract. Without regulation, we will definitely not get there. The public needs to understand that there are trade-offs. The public needs to buy into this and needs to believe that the regulators are implementing the public's wishes.
Can you think of a time in history where we faced a similar decision or maybe even something smaller?
Well, maybe this is taking it a little too far, but the analogy that I like to make is with the birth of the social contract, which is the foundation of modern democracy. In the 1600s, an English philosopher called Thomas Hobbes has basically laid the foundation of the social contract by saying that essentially government is an agreement between the public, between the people, to give certain powers to a central entity, and this government would basically enact the will of the people and help them get along. So enforce property rights, the rule of law, and so on. But what happens is then, at the same time, the people need to have checks and balances on this power. And I think what's happening now is at the core similar, but also fundamentally different, in that people are now giving powers to algorithms, and these powers have consequences on everyone, and we similarly need ways to keep checks and balances on those powers. And we are just beginning to learn how to do that, because when the government or the regulation is made up of people, we know how to deal with people. We don't really know how to do this with machines yet.